Good. Okay, today I would like to report about some ongoing work which started when Sanjeev Kumar came to Augsburg as a postdoc, which is a couple of months ago, and after having finished his thesis in India with Pinaki Majumdar. So there is a quite an ambitious title, but towards a global phase diagram for perovskite manganites. But as I will show you, this is the title is kind of borrowed from experimental work, which is goes to the credit of Yoshinori Tokura, who kind of summarized many existing samples in an attempt for a global phase diagram. And we simply take this as a guidance, and so I will report to you today where we are with the our calculations following up on this guidance. So I have only 15 plus a little minutes, so I will single out what I think are the most important part out of this essentially, well, 1 hour talk. So I would like to talk to you about the recent experiments. I will today focus, I apologize for some others in the audience, so on Yoshinori Tokura's experimental phase diagrams. And the key thing is that apparently much can be cast into two parameters, the disorder strength and the bandwidth. And I will show you what type of calculations we are trying for some simple simplified models for manganites. And at the end, I will tell you where from here on we most likely have to go. So I will make my introduction very short on this this transparency, well known to all of you. I would only like to point out this particular one. Here, this shows the manganese-oxygen-manganese bond, and in the middle there is the rare earth or the alkaline earth. And what is important is if one replaces a smaller size rare earth ion, let's say, or alkaline earth ion, then this bond angle is getting reduced. The smaller this ion in the middle is, the more this bond angle is reduced, and you can imagine that by this effect, actually, the bandwidth is getting reduced. So by the size of this additional cation in the middle, there is a control parameter for the effective bandwidth in the materials. So we have seen some of the phase diagrams for selected manganite materials. Here's lanthanum-strontium manganite, then neodymium-strontium. Here is with lanthanum, praseodymium, with calcium doped in there. All of them have not identical phases, and they're all complex, have similar phases, but there are clearly differences. And so one has to seek for some guidance how to single out the most important features or the global aspects of all these phase diagrams. A hint can come from taking praseodymium manganite at one, let's say, fixed x. X is fixed always at the two above diagrams here, and varying the relative concentration of the rare earth, the alkaline earth, excuse me, ion, calcium, or strontium. So you can see that in some cases, let's see, for X.35, you have wide regions of ferromagnetic metallic phases and smaller regions of charge-ordered, orbital-ordered insulating regions. The relative size of that is changing if you do a variation in Y. And in fact, this is nothing else than representing, as I said before, a variation in bandwidth. From the left to the right, from here on this axis, from Y going from 0 to 1, you can think of in terms of an enlarged bandwidth, increasing bandwidth. So one can go once, or Tokura went one step further, and actually it's possible to summarize 50 different manganite compounds in one very impressive phase diagram. What is plotted here is the horizontal axis, is the average radius of the cation, so we can translate it into bandwidth. And the vertical axis is giving the variance of this cation radius. So what you can see here is in that region we have ferromagnetic metallic phases. These lines tell the Curie temperatures for the transition to ferromagnetism. Here in the left corner, not easy to read, antiferromagnetic insulating, charge ordered order, orbital ordered, and the glassy-like region up here. So the vertical axis is increasing disorder. The horizontal axis is then is in fact increasing bandwidth. So this is the diagram we are taking for guidance. When we have also yesterday learned from Jeff Lynn's talk, that there's a possibility to prepare manganites at 0.5 doping, either in an ordered way or in this ordered way. So here the phase time was shown, temperature versus ionic radius, again, bandwidth, again, that's the way I will follow to think of. So the abrupt change, the boundary between ferromagnetism and the insulating phases is then kind of reduced for the disordered case. So this line is the case for the ordered samples, which is an ordered stacking of barium layers and the rare earth layers. And if it's getting disordered, you see it's getting suppressed, but it also gives rise to a glassy phase right here. So that in fact is the alkaline or rare earth ion radius can be translated into bandwidth. I think another hint for this is has come from pressure experiments, because it turns out that if you look at, let's say, at 0.5 doping again, neodymium barium manganese or samarium barium manganese oxide, you can see that actually the one of the samples here, the samarium sample at finite pressure, looks exactly in that phase diagram as the neodymium sample at zero pressure. So we really can take this as another evidence that indeed the good and reasonable control parameter is the bandwidth. So here's what I would like to summarize here for what I take from these experiments as a guidance. Many manganese can be cast in terms of two parameters, bandwidth and disorder. And let's try to see if we take this as a guidance and how can we proceed by doing the calculations for manganese models. So I will skip much of this and simply try to say where's our starting point. This is the Hamiltonian, not still the complete one, but this is what we put in. Kinetic energy, it's a two-band model, 2 eV electrons are taken into account. So we have T alpha beta, which is hopping between the two different available orbitals. We have a disorder term, we have an additional coupling to the spins, the Hund's-Rule coupling to the localized T2G spins. We have additional super exchange, and we also have the terms from coupling to the lattice, which goes via this pseudospin operators for the orbital degrees of freedom. And in addition, we have, of course, if there is a lattice distortion, capital Q, we have to pay a price, and this is captured then by the stiffness constant. So this is our Hamiltonian. What is not yet complete, because what is not in there are Coulomb correlations, which is Hubbard U, let's say, between electrons sitting on the EG orbitals. So how do we proceed? We treat the lattice degrees of freedom in the adiabatic limit. The core spins are treated as classical variables. And then it's still a difficult problem because we have quench disorder and we have annealed disorder, because we have to find the optimum spin configuration for the core spins plus the optimum configurations of the lattice distortion. Now we have to proceed and make it furthermore a little bit simpler. We go to the double exchange limit, taking the Hund's-Rule coupling to infinity. In essence, that means that the EG spins are really slaved along the direction of the core T2G spins. That's one of the simplification we're doing. So what is then the task? Well, we have to look for the partition function, which is then can be written as an integral over the core spin variables, the degrees of freedom for the lattice distortion, and of course a trace over the Fermi inverse, the electrons, right? So, but this all can be cast in terms of an effective Hamiltonian for the lattice degrees of freedom and the core spins. And of course, this is then in some sense now a classical Hamiltonian, but of course it's determined by taking the trace over the fermionic degrees of freedom. So we have in a given configuration always find the eigenstates for the electrons, and then taking the trace, calculate the energy, and then possibly modify the structure for the lattice distortions and the local core spins. So this is a similar in spirit to what we heard in the last talk. So how can one proceed? In principle, one can combine exact diagonalization and classical Monte Carlo here, but we heard also in last talk, this is very costly and time consuming. So the idea that Sanjeev Kumar put forward is, instead of always doing for a given realization of core spin and lattice distortion, doing the full ED for the whole lattice, he came up with the idea of doing what he called a traveling cluster approximation. That is, instead of diagonalizing the full system at each Monte Carlo step, he rather actually singles out a little cluster, makes the and diagonalizes within that cluster, and lets the cluster sweep over the whole lattice. So the gain is actually that the computational time is not going to as n to the n to the fourth, but rather we have it reduced linear in system size by n cubed, but for the nc, meaning this is the size of the individual cluster. Achievable sizes then are up to 1,000 sites for the total system, for let's say a number of sites, 100 within the cluster. So given that procedure, we, if I say 1,000, that essentially means 32 by 32 type systems. So given that, we calculate the obvious quantity, spin structure factor, orbit structure factor, density of state, electronic density, and conductivity using the Kubo formula. And from this also, we extract the resistivity as a function of temperature by doing a scaling analysis for the conductivity and also taking the zero frequency limit to pull out the DC number of the conductivity. So we did certainly some comparisons how this cluster method works in comparison to the exact results. And let's see, these are results for two dimensions, one dimensions for, and actually these are data from Albio's group. So you might say the blue dots are if the full diagonalization is done, let's say here for an L equal to 8 by 8 system in 2D. So if the cluster size is 8 by 8, of course, that means the full system is exactly diagonalized. But if we reduce our cluster size to half of it, we can already see that's very good agreement, which gives us confidence that the method works fine.
Can you also say, when you say one time, you catch this 4 by 4 cluster together with the best, what you want is all the eigenvalues, right, for the full block.
That's right. So you locally calculate within the cluster, you do the diagonalization. You do it from patch to patch to patch, and to make a decision for the update of the variables. So you sweep around your full lattice. So the full diagonalization is not always done in within the full system, but only in a subsection. I'm running out of time. I can explain it to detail later on how that in detail works. So here's, in the absence of disorder for a fixed super exchange coupling, there is a phase diagram we have termed. Here's a phase diagram which is coupling to the lattice degrees of freedom versus density. So we get the expected phases, all this short notation with orbital disorder, spin, ferromagnetic, and metallic. So we get all or quite a number of the phases we expect to see in comparison to the true manganite phase diagram. But what is actually what Sanjeev, I think, has good reason to be proud of is actually that in that scheme we get quite promising looking results for resistivity versus temperature. So this is now an example here for fixed electron lattice coupling constant, fixed super exchange at three different doping levels with different strengths of disorder. Black is no disorder, red intermediate, and blue is big disorder, right? So we either have rho versus T curves, which are simply looking like an insulator. We have regimes where the system undergoes a transition towards a ferromagnetic metallic phase. And that's exactly like the plots actually we have seen in the, or I didn't point it out to you, which were on the slides that I showed at the very beginning. And of course that the transition to the metallic state is connected to ferromagnetism is made clear if one does in one plot resistivity versus temperature and magnetization versus temperature. And depending on parameter where one is, one can either have a transition from, let's call this the ferromagnetic insulating phase. Here is would be the Curie temperature, then the resistivity drops and it goes into a ferrometallic phase. But depending where we are in parameters, let's say with weaker disorder, we can also go from a paramagnetic metallic phase to a ferromagnetic metallic phase. So much of the features in there, this density of states I won't discuss today. Of course, underlying all these scenarios and different parameter regions are of course also inhomogeneous structures. This is a pattern for the local density and the whole system. How many?
Three or four.
Thank you. Okay, I'll finish in a second. No, not in a second, in a minute, okay. And so here is one more example. I would like to show you now for, again, fixed carrier concentration 0.4 now, with from left to right, I increase the disorder. And again, the resistivity is shown as a function of temperature. In principle, Or here one can say one can distinguish free transport regimes, either being it perfectly insulating, or it can go really from this paramagnetic insulating to ferromagnetic metallic, or in that regime we might even think it goes from a paramagnetic metal to a ferromagnetic metal. And again, one has to, now I would like to come back to the introduction. We have now, if I go back to the global phase diagram, one control parameter was the bandwidth. In essence, it would mean in these different samples, in the different manganite compounds, we would be changing something like an effective hopping. And in fact, this would mean, since we are used to scale all our variables in terms of bandwidth, in principle, one is marching then along a complicated curve, because in principle, there are simultaneously changes in this electron lattice coupling from the super exchange and also the disorder strength. So let me summarize. Maybe, is that okay? Almost time, okay. So this is our guidance again, this global phase diagram. And well, this is where we are at the moment. So we plot at least in the vertical scale the disorder strength to be identified with a variant in cation radius. And on the horizontal axis, we plot lambda, electron lattice coupling constant, but going from large to small. And of course, this is made in spirit by saying that, in fact, this is lambda over bandwidth. So if I'm going from left to right and I would like to increase bandwidth, well, that's the approach. Then I can think in terms of lambda over T going down. But in essence, it's not a changing electron lattice coupling constant, but rather the change in the bandwidth. So you might say, well, that's still very far from this. Yes, that's absolutely true. But I think one can learn that the ingredients are all there to understand part, at least, of the trends going on. And of course, we have the glass seal. I didn't talk about this now, but there's also an insulated and glass seal-like phase. We still have to verify that there's hysteresis going on, but we would characterizing as ferromagnetic insulating, but it doesn't have the full possible magnetization. And of course, more realistic modeling is still necessary. In fact, I use this, or we use disorder as local potentials, but rather we might learn that disorder might be rather more to be seeked in the hoppings, right? And then if one varies bandwidth, in principle, we have then to vary in a consistent way all the parameters in that Hamiltonian that we are using, because all the parameters are at the end scaled by bandwidth. No work is still in progress, but this taken as a guidance, I think we have some hope that we can march along the right direction. Thank you.
Okay, that's enough time for questions.
In this beautiful curve of resistivity going up and down,
yeah.
When you look at the configuration that comes from the Monte Carlo,
yeah.
Is a percolation happening as we expect there? And do you see any indication of that?
Just from eyeballing the structure, yes, from eyeballing it, it looks like that it is having to do with that, absolutely, yeah. But how to quantify it, I don't quite know yet, right? But just from eyeballing the patches and the structures we are looking at, the charge patterns and all that, yes, it pretty much looks like this, I agree with that. It's hard to quantify, but still, eyeballing, yes.
What density was that?
This one?
Not that one, but the resistivity itself. The one before. 0.4. 0.4.
Mm-hmm. 0.45. We usually used, we did not sweep the whole doping so far. The phase diagram I showed was without disorder, just to guide where we are with our parameters. So in the presence of this, we have not sweeped the full. And so we mostly concentrated on 0.4 at the moment. You might say JS might still be too small, but still something is happening. If you increase JS in particular at 0.5 doping, then JS is still doing something to the phases you're in. So that's far from exploring the whole thing, right? And all I wanted to report today is really there is guidance now from this Tokura phase diagram, and this will be, and along those lines, we were trying to, well, optimize the calculation, of course, but also the way we look in different parameter regimes. But point four is the answer here for, I think, the resistivity curves you were referring to.
Yeah. There's no disorder in the system, right?
Yes. Oh, with the black one, yes. That's right.
So it's homogeneous.
That's correct.
Where dissipation comes from?
In the absence of disorder, while the lattice can distort, we have static lattice distortions. The electrons, we had this semantics about polarons or not, but we have the coupling to static lattice degrees of freedom, and this is the source for scattering the electrons. Okay, so this is still in there. That static lattice distortions are present, even if you turn off the true disorder potential. No, not necessarily. You can trap and dig holes for the electrons, and so they're not necessarily. It can happen, in particular at the commensurate fillings, we know, but we were on purpose working off the commensurate fillings, and there you can trap different. You see density variations, and they are intimately coupled, of course, to the local lattice distortions you have. And these are the sources of scattering for the electron. That's why we get insulating, real resistivity, even in the absence of the disorder thing. So it's the local deformation of the lattice.
Is it activated, or is it simple activation, or it's helping?
You mean the insulating behavior here?
Yeah.
Well, we have, of course, the underlying, why is it doing this? The underlying state is a charge-ordered orbital-ordered insulating state. And there is, of course, a gap in the state, in the spectrum.
It's activation.
Yes. Yeah, this is the charge-ordered orbital-ordered insulator here, in that parameter regime.
But once you have disorder, presumably you have states in the gap as well. So it should probably go into some sort of...
You want to see the density of states. Yeah, the density of state is not gapped. In the presence of this disorder, the density of state is not gapped.
Right.
Here's the density of states. I can show it to you, but it's where's the mobility at, right? And you have localized and propagating states.
I'm just curious about the temperature dependence. Is it really mobility gap, or is it Hopping conduction? If you put it on a log scale, you'll see.
Hopping conduction. I'm sorry. Yes, you have to do some scaling. We can do a little better than 32 by 32. It's already big, I expect that it's hopping conductivity at that point, right? The gap is not perfect. There's no perfect gap. It's in the presence of disorder here.
Okay.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you. Okay, thank you very much. By using this short presentation, I want to show you our recent theoretical efforts to understand the effects of disorder in double action systems. My name is Yuki Motome from RIKEN, and my collaborators are Nobuo Furukawa and Naoto Nagaosa. This is the outline of my talk. So I want to show you three short stories. They are different, but a little bit related. Stories are on the effects of disorder in double action systems. One first story is on the Curie temperature TC. Here I want to show you our world record Monte Carlo simulation in size. And in the second part, I will show you the effects of disorder on spin excitation spectrum. So here I want to show you how the disorder affects the spin excitation spectrum in this spin and charge coupled system. And in the last part, I want to show you the effect of disorder on competing phases. This is a hot topic in this mini workshop. And I want to show you our findings. It is the disorder-induced insulator to metal transition in the microscopic model. and I want to discuss the origin of CMR in the last part. So let me start from the very introduction to show you several experimental evidences for the importance of the disorder in CMR manganites, and I want to show you our strategy and motivation. So I start from this beautiful phase diagram by the so-called bandwidth control, but as you already know that the these, for example, this is the phase diagram as a function of tolerance factor for x equals 0.3, and this is the, this was already shown in the last talk, this is the phase diagram in rather close to the commensurate filling 0.5, and as you know, these are that bandwidth control is a kind of average physics picture. So the question is, does this average physics work or not? And the answer is no. So one typical breakdown of this average physics picture, bandwidth control picture, is a change of TC. Here I show the TC, this dashed curve, as a function of the average of ionic radius of cations. And then this solid curve is the estimated effective bandwidth estimated from this structural data. Then if we compare lanthanum strontium compound here and lanthanum calcium compound, then TC decreases about 30% from here to here. But effective bandwidth changes a little. It only decreased 2%. So there is one order of magnitude difference between the change of TC and change of effective bandwidth. So, and you know that within the direction theory, the TC scales to bandwidth. So this is a kind of breakdown of the, and this is, this cannot be explained by simple direction theory with simple bandwidth control. Another counterexample is found in spin excitation spectrum. This is the experimental results for the spin excitation spectrum for some compounds with relatively high TC. It is believed to have some wide bandwidth. Then you can see very beautiful cosine-like dispersion here. And this is a theory for the simple direction theory. So this spectrum can be explained by simple direction theory. So this is good. But if you go to some compounds with relatively low TC, it is believed to have some narrow bandwidth. Then you will see some kind of anomalies here. Here you can see some softening near the zone boundary. And also here you can see some anti-crossing behavior with gap opening. And clearly, these deviations from simple cosine-like dispersion cannot be explained by this directing theory with bandwidth control. And there are several indications, experimental indications for the importance of disorder. One is residual resistivity. You can see that residual resistivity goes up systematically as TC decreases. And the I don't show here, but the specific heat doesn't show any significant mass enhancement. So this clearly indicates that the importance of this disorder as a scatterer of electrons. The second point is that TC scales to the standard deviation of A-site ionic radius. And this is already pointed out in the high TC context in the last week. And this is a plot. And the last point is that we can see some sample dependence of spin excitation spectra. I'm not sure here about this. And the recently, some experimental groups have proposed rather direct evidence of the importance of disorder. This is already shown by the last speaker. This is newly found disorder controllable compounds. They can make order and disordered compounds. And the phase diagram is very different between them. In the clean limit, we have this kind of competing phases between ferromagnetic metallic phase and charge and orbital insulating phase. But if we introduce disorder, then this insulating phase disappears. And some glassy phase remains at low temperature. And on the other hand, ferromagnetic metallic phase is robust, and it extends to like here. So in this multicritical regime, you can have disorder-induced insulator to metal transition. Actually, in the ordered phase, resistivity goes up, but in the disordered case, it is metallic at low temperature. And in this regime, you can have typical CMR effects. So this is a kind of direct experimental evidence for the importance of disorder for on CMR effect. So we want to understand the effect of disorder in this kind of diverging system. So our strategy is the following. So as you already seen in the previous talks, and there are already complexity in models for manganese. There are too many things. And on top of those, we need to include disorder. This is too much, at least for me. So we want to go back. We want to go back to the start line, and we restart from a minimal model with Clenchy disorder, and we want to examine how far we can reach and what is beyond of that. That is our strategy. So our starting model is very simple. This is simple diverging model with Clenchy disorder. So this is single band model, so there is no orbital degeneracy, and we are working in the double exchange limit. It is a strong screw coupling limit, and we treat local spins as classic objects. And also we introduce simple disorder. It is on-site potential disorder. So this is a sketch of our model, and this is a Hamiltonian. So here we introduce the on-site disorder, this epsilon I. And later in the final part, we will add phonons to describe phase competitions. I will show you the Hamiltonian later. Okay, let me start from Curie temperature TC. So here we applied the truncated polynomial expansion method, which we have developed in these 5 years. And the method itself was already introduced by Dr. Gonzalo Alvarez, so we skip the details. I just demonstrate how the method works here. So this is the example of Monte Carlo data in the clean limit without disorder. And here I show the system size dependence of the structure factor of ferromagnetic component up to 20 cube sites. So this is 8,000 sites containing 4,000 electrons. So I think this is a world record type calculation in this context. So you can see very nice system size scaling, and you can estimate the values in the sound dynamic limit. Then you can plot the magnetization in the sound dynamic limit as a function of temperature, and you can apply this kind of scaling to estimate TC and beta here. And the beta is completely consistent with Heisenberg University class here. And this method works well also in the presence of disorder. This is an example for the some values of the strength of disorder. You can see nice scaling here also. And this is a plot of the temperature dependence of magnetization for several different strengths of disorder. So you can see that the disorder suppresses the magnetization and TC goes down. And one comment is that even in the presence of disorder, still the universality class is Heisenberg universality class. So this is consistent with Harris's criterion, which the chairman mentioned in last week. So yeah, we have calculated many things, but I just show here the suppression of TC by disorder. So this is the plot of TC as a function.
You don't get long tails.
Long tail of what?
The magnetization?
No, because this is a plot for the thermodynamic limit. So it is completely zero at high temperature. If you do in the finite size system, then you have tail. But this is in the infinite system. Okay? Size extrapolated. Okay, so this is a plot of TC as a function of the square of delta. This is the strength of disorder, delta square. Then you can see this kind of scaling. So the decrease of TC is proportional to delta square. Okay, this is okay. And this is a hand-waving argument. But if we believe that lanthanum-strontium compound is effectively very clean, then 30% reduction of TC can be achieved by around here, delta equals 0.5 or 0.5 W. W is half bandwidth, so it is considered to be 1 eV. So this corresponds to 0.5 eV. And this is more or less reasonable value if you look up this first principle estimation for the electrostatic potential disorder. Okay, so And one drawback here is that transition is always continuous because disorder is irrelevant. So we cannot reproduce first order nature of the lanthanum calcium compound as we have seen in the last day's talks. So maybe we need some phonons or a kind of, so this is future work. So this is a short story for TC. And let me move on to spin excitation spectrum. Here, we applied very different approach, not Monte Carlo. This is just a spin wave approximation for the double exchange model. And the I don't have enough time to show you the details of the method, but the, anyway, we are working in real space because we have this order. And the in the lowest order of 1 over expansion, we can have effective Heisenberg model with coupling JIJ, which is given by this kind of relation. So JIJ is given by kinetic energy in of the double exchange model. So here, the fermion behavior comes in. I just show you some typical example of our data. This is the spectrum in the 3D system in the absence of disorder. So here you can see very nice Heisenberg cosine dispersion. If you introduce disorder, the spectrum gets broader. And if you increase disorder, then some new feature comes in, appears, shows up here. So you can see some branching here. And we have additional lower energy branch here. So I don't have enough time to show you many data, but anyway, I summarize here the features of the anomalies. Anomalies are robust against various types of disorder, and also they become more apparent in lower dimension, and also they show some correlation with fermion wave number Ks. So from these facts, we concluded that the origin of these anomalies in the model is that Friedel oscillation in half-metallic systems. So if we introduce disorder, then there are itinerant electrons, so they tend to screen the disorder. So there is 2kF charge oscillation. This is Friedel oscillation in the textbook. But the important point is that the system is perfectly polarized, half-metallic system. So the charge oscillation equals the spin oscillation. So we can have 2kF spin oscillations by non-magnetic disorder in this kind of half-metallic system. So this couples to magnon, and it scatters magnon at 2kF. So we can have this kind of anti-crossing feature in the spectrum. This is the origin of the anomalies in our model. Let me compare our results with experimental results. So if you consider the simpleness of our model, then the agreement is rather good. And the, of course, there are several other theoretical proposals, there are many. And we are proposing several experimental tests to distinguish these theories. So if you are interested in, please ask me later. And very recently, we are now trying to extend this calculation to the ferromagnetic droplet states. These are Sakurai's group data, and these are the preliminary data of our calculations, but I don't have enough time to show you this, so I skip this. Okay, last topic is the effect of disorder on competing phases. So here, in order to describe the phase competition between ferromagnetic metallic phase and charge ordered insulating phase, we need to extend the model a little bit. So here we included phonons here, but still the model is single band. So the phonons are breathing type mode. So it couples density and it induces a checkerboard type charge ordering. Okay? And here we keep disorder here. And here, again, we applied Monte Carlo simulation for some dynamics, but here we applied just a conventional Monte Carlo simulation in a smaller scale. Okay, this is a phase diagram in the absence of disorder. Then, and this is temperature, and this is the electron phonon coupling constant. This is zero, and this is large G. Then, here you can see, G is zero, so this is double exchange model. So you can have ferromagnetic metallic phase at low temperatures. And here, for large G, this induces checkerboard type charge ordering. So you can have charge ordering insulator here. And in between, we have uniform mixed phase, which has both ferromagnetic ordering and charge ordering. And this is insulator. So this is a kind of tetracritical phase diagram. And if you introduce disorder, then this TCO goes down a lot. So the charge-ordered insulator phase is fragile against disorder. And if you increase disorder a little more, then charge-ordering the insulating phase disappears in this parameter regime, and but ferromagnetic metallic phase is robust. So the change of phase diagram is schematically summarized here. So charge ordered phase. No, because this is single band model. Just a check about charge ordering. Okay, so the charge ordered insulator phase is very weak for this order and it disappears. And the so here in this multi-critical regime we can have transition from insulating state to metallic state. Actually, we have calculated density of state and optical conductivity in this regime. Then, these gray lines are for the delta equals zero, I mean, disorder-free, clean case. Then you can see some gap here, density of state and sigma omega. But if you introduce disorder, then gap is filled, and also the sigma and the low energy component appears in the sigma omega. So this shows clearly the tendency from the insulator to metal in this microscopic model. And this is recently confirmed by Abel Dagos group in a slightly different model. Sorry?
What's the energy scale?
For example, this peak, this. I think it is related to the phonon displacement. Because here we have breathing type phonon and charge ordering comes in. Okay? So in the strong coupling limit, the density of state is spiky. So it goes up and it becomes spiky, upper Hubbard band-like. Okay? So the more interesting point is the contrastive effect of this order. So as I have shown in the previous view graph, you see below TC.
The sorry? One.
Yeah?
When you say disorder induced insulator to metal, you're getting states at zero frequency.
Yeah.
That is what you are calling
yeah.
metal?
Yes.
Yeah. How do you know these states are conducting states? How do you know that?
I don't know. It's a very subtle problem because this is 2D calculation. So, yeah. We cannot say it's very subtle problem. But anyway, I want to show here is the very clear tendency from insulating like state to metallic state. Okay? The more interesting point is that the contrastive effects of this order. So as I have shown, at low temperature in the multi-critical regime, we have this kind of tendency. But at high temperature, okay, I'll finish. At high temperature, the tendency is opposite. So this order decreases the metallic tendency. So the sigma omega develops this kind of pseudo-gap features. So there is some contrastive effect at low temperature, between low temperature and high temperature. So the problem is what the role of this order is here. So this order is a potential disorder here in this model. So this is just a pinning to commensurate charge ordering. Okay? So it induces the antiphase boundaries like this. It pins the charge ordering pattern. So it kills the long range ordering easily. But here the important point is that this kind of domain walls can gain extra entropy because we have many ways to put the domain walls here. So in this high temperature regime, because of this pinning, charge ordering becomes short range. But we have domain walls, and we can gain some extra entropy. So here, some insulating state with charge pseudo gap with short range correlation can be stabilized. But at low temperature, because of this pinning, charge long range ordering is never stabilized. And in this range, in the end, ferromagnetic metallic state overtakes in the subtle energy competition. So we can have some re-entrant behavior from high temperature insulating state to low temperature metallic state in this multi-critical regime. So this re-entrant behavior is a good reason to have some CMR effect because we can expect this kind of temperature dependence in resistivity, although we cannot explicitly show in numerical simulation So still we need some dialect to make a confirmation of this behavior. And probably the last talk gave some evidence for this kind of behavior. And also, we believe that our model, simple model, can capture some essence of physics in this disorder direction system, but still we need some extension to complexity. I mean, some more realistic models, as you have seen in the last talk. And the one point is that in our single band model, pinning was just a pinning to charge degrees of freedom. But in realistic model, there should be some structural pinning to orbital or Jahn-Teller structural degrees of freedom. So it can enhance an instating behavior in this region. Okay, maybe I'm running out of time, so just show you the summary. So thank you very much for your attention.
You said the disorder is the reason for having the zone boundary line on softening and involvement. I thought in a more recent paper that Nagosa suggested that it's the orbital part that really induces the orbital, it's the orbital part that really induces the line on softening. I was wondering, in the disorder scenario that you suggested, that what is the doping dependence of the spin excitations you would expect?
Yeah.
Say, for example, from 25%
so that's a good point. Actually, in our theory, as I mentioned, there is a strong correlation between the anomalies and the Fermi wave number. Okay. So the position of anomaly moves as the when you change the doping. Okay. So.
The simple question from experimentalist point of view is: do you expect more doping?
I think the strength of softening depends on, for example, the strength of disorder or number of scatterers. Okay. What I'm saying is that the position of, for example, this point depends on Fermi energy, Fermi wave number. Actually, in our calculation, this arrow shows the position of KS. So if we change the doping, then this anomaly shifts. And also, if we go to the low doping regime, then effectively disorder becomes relevant. So the anomaly becomes larger. We expect that.
This particular example is not particularly good. This 20% stuff. That's actually the insulator.
This one?
Yeah,
yes, this one is insulating.
Yeah, that one. We now have done a systematic study of the doping dependence of spin excitation. We found when you just go beyond the hypothesis here, when you just go beyond the insulin regime, it's actually cosine light.
Mm-hmm.
As you rapidly approach 30-40%, the zone boundary softening appears to be more and more. I think that's actually consistent with.
Is it consistent with the Sacred people's data?
They haven't done anything about 20%.
20.
The metal infinite transition.
Because this is a 20% data for carbon.
From 25%, yeah.
25.
Yeah, 22% is the boundary between insulin and ground. The first sample we did is 25%.
Mm-hmm.
It's 25, 30, and 45%.
Mm-hmm.
And we find that as you gradually approach the 40% regime, that the zone boundary becomes more and more. 45% is actually more or less consistent with this recent PRL by Yoshi Indos.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Actually.
So that seems to be more consistent with the orbital aspect that Nagosa was emphasizing in one of his papers. So I'm just wondering, how.
Yeah, I don't know, but in our model, this is a very simple model, and there is some strong correlation between KF and anomaly position. Okay. So it depends on the form of the Fermi surface. Okay. So in a more realistic model, we can have very complicated Fermi surface. So the position of anomaly depends on that.
But the 20% sample is not even a metal, it's insulator.
This is insulator, yes. But there is some anisotropy, and 2D anisotropy. So in our model, if we introduce 2D anisotropy or 1D anisotropy, we can have some insulating state by disorder. Okay.
One more question there.
Sorry, my mind is for a moment. I was wondering about the stream waves. Is that not dense by particle volume excitation?
Sorry? This is a magnetic excitation.
Fully polarized.
Yeah, fully polarized. Yeah.
Okay, I see no more questions. Thank you again.
Thank you very much.
Okay, so at first I would like to take the opportunity to thank the organizers for having the chance to be here. I think it's a very marvelous meeting and I'm learning a lot and I'm looking forward to the upcoming weeks. So in the last talk of this section, I want to completely switch gears and come to some different topic. In fact, what I want to do is I want to boldly confine myself to one of those structures that has been reappearing frequently over several talks that we have listened to, namely to the spin ladder. And I want to convince you that in the spin ladders, actually, there is a channel of transport, namely thermal transport, which somehow has been overlooked for quite some time and which turns out to be rather anomalous. So this is a work which I have been doing in collaboration with a former PhD student of mine who is still at Braunschweig but will be leaving soon, with Andreas Honecker and Daniel Cabra from the University of Strasbourg. I also would like to mention that we have greatly benefited from the fact that we, as theoreticians, could sneak in onto the very early papers of the experimental physicists which actually discovered some of these phenomena. So, in this brief presentation, the three punchlines that I want to bring across is actually, if you look at the thermal transport in spin ladders and other low dimensional quantum magnets that I cannot focus on during the brevity of time, that indeed the thermal response is very large. And I will show you what I mean by that. Then I want to show you that thermal transport very strongly discriminates between having integrable spin models or non-integrable spin models. And indeed, that in the former one of these, transport to a certain degree is trivial, since everything is driven by extrinsic scattering, while in the latter one of these, to which the spin ladder compounds belong, thermal transport is quite non-trivial and is driven by intrinsic scattering. And finally, at the end, if I have time, I will actually try to convince you that indeed, on the spin ladder compounds, thermal transport, as the theory describes it, can also capture the experiment. So just to jump into the topic right away, this shows as a function of temperature, the thermal conductivity of the telephone number compound, one of its particular ways of realizing it. And there are four things that you should take away from this single experiment. Namely, first, the number on this y-axis. If you never have looked on thermal transport, that doesn't mean a thing to you. The point is, if you take highly purified quartz, or something that is taken as a heat transducer, say in a lab, it's somewhere at room temperature resides here. So these numbers are really very large. Second, there's a two-peak feature, the lower one of which can be attributed to longitudinal phonons and can be subtracted off. Finally, this thing is highly anisotropic, so transverse to the ladders which reside here, the response is rather small. But in the direction of the ladders, the response is large. And if you look at the low temperature form of this, you will find an exponential activation energy to that, which is exactly the spin gap of the ladders. So this tells you that indeed there are magnetic excitations which carry the heat along that system. Now, if you want to get a feeling of actually how large this is, you might want to make a first very simplistic assault by doing some Boltzmann type of approach in which you plug in the dispersion for the magnetic excitations as has been given to us a long time ago by one of our chairmen, Zervium, and you take the specific heat of those guys and you extract the mean free path. And what you see here is that the mean free path at low temperatures goes up to something like 3,000 angstroms, which amounts to 700 lattice constants in the system. So this immediately, as it was found some 3 years ago, led many theoretical groups to claim that there is some strange conservation law going on, which may lead to ballistic heat transport on these systems. And to answer this question, we have started a study of a very large class of low-dimensional pure spin models, which we simply subsum under this notion of a frustrated zigzag spin one-half ladder. Essentially, this is this topology on which you have spin one-halves residing, and you have five parameters, namely two exchange parameters, one, so to speak, global exchange parameter, and then there's magnetic field, and there's also exchange anisotropy. Now, this innocent little model can cover a large phase space of or realizations of different systems. Actually, the spin ladder, for example, is down here. If you have lambda, the parameter lambda, so the blue guy is just to zero, and you scan alpha, so you can realize spin ladders. Or if you go on this direction, you can study dimerized spin chains, for which there are also thermal transport measurements. Or if you run along the line here, you're just looking at single Heisenberg spin chains, and both in their massive or massless critical regime. So now, first, just to get you started, and in a nutshell, what are you actually measuring here, and what is the topic that we ask? So the local energy density in a Heisenberg system is just a spin squared. So if you want to know what the current is, you do a continuity equation, and from that you know that the spin current is essentially a three product of spins. So this is your current. So in a time domain, what you'd expect is that the current will decay, and usually it will decay to zero. If you're lucky, it may stay at some constant value as time goes by. In the frequency domain, this translates into a heat conductivity, which has a regular part, which essentially comes from this fall-off, and then maybe or maybe not a Drude peak, which is just the delta function at omega is equal to zero. So whenever, and obviously the experiment is done here at omega is equal to zero, or maybe a little bit off that, there is no such thing as a finite frequency thermal conductivity measurement, at least not to my knowledge. So the red guy here is different from zero, we would be speaking about a ballistic transport. If it is zero, then we just have the regular part and we would talk about dissipative or non-ballistic transport. So to be more specific, what do we do to answer this question? It's just one view graph of things that we actually calculate. So I don't have time to really tell you about all the transport coefficients that we calculate. Today, I'm just focusing on the heat current driven in the magnetic system. But actually, what we study is both field and temperature gradient. So you have a little 2x2 matrix with three different transport coefficients that you actually want to calculate. So the currents are simply given by continuity equation, both for the spin and the local energy density, so the heat current. So you have two currents, and you want to calculate the response functions. So the response functions are down here. There are two parts of them. So the Drude peak, which you want to know about. The main point about the Drude peak is that obviously these are those parts where the heat current just connects degenerate states. So the main point is that the Drude weight will sample that part of the Hilbert space where you connect degenerate states, while the regular part obviously does that for non-degenerate states. So now the question is how to evaluate these guys essentially without approximation, and to answer this question about being ballistic or dissipative in these systems. So we want to do something that really answers this question. So you want to know, is this guy one or is this zero? So how do you do that? I will try to convince you that indeed by doing finite system dialyzations, including all eigenstates and all eigenvectors on finite systems and doing the right way of extrapolation to the thermodynamic limit, you can answer these questions. As long as the system is integrable, we have other tools that we also apply to get answers, namely bosonization or the beta ansatz. And if you want to play, you can also use Jordan-Wigner fermions, but these are uncontrolled approximations that you have to use to apply the lower line here. So we just use that for comparison with other results that we have. So now let me come to the first set of results. Now we just look at a single spin chain, right? So this is the first thing that we look at with icing anisotropy. In a sense, this is a warm-up. Why? Well, because the heat current actually commutes with the Hamiltonian. So we know right from the start, even though this is a non-trivial model, right? The spin current, for example, does not commute with the Hamiltonian in this case. So this is a non-trivial case. Still, the heat current commutes with the Hamiltonian. So we know we will get the finite Luder weight. So we can check that, or we have checked that with various techniques. So in this, you see as a function of temperature, the Luder weight, as calculated from beta ansatz, from conformal field theory and the low temperature limit, and also from Jordan-Wigner fermions. Well, Jordan-Wigner fermions, yeah, the parameter here is the Ising anisotropy. So the lowest curve here just corresponds to the XY case, in which we know that Jordan-Wigner fermions are exact. So there, the beta ansatz and the Jordan-Wigner fermions just fall on top. So we know the Luder weight is finite here, and we have ballistic transport. Now, the thing that we want to check here is if the numerical technique is, so looking at full spectrum diagonalization, we'll be able to find the same answer, namely that the transport is ballistic. So what you see on the lower plot here is, as a function of temperature, the Luder weight for various systems up to 20 sites. And you see that for the largest systems that we have, there are essentially no finite size effects above, say, a temperature of 0.4 times the change coupling constant. And the red curves essentially just follow the black curve, which is the beta ansatz. So from these finite system diagonalizations, at sufficiently large enough temperature, you can answer the question, is the system ballistic or is it non-ballistic? So is there dissipation or is there no dissipation? So to make this more quantitative, what we usually look at is the high temperature residue of the exact ionization data. And this is shown here in a wide parameter scan of the anisotropy parameter of the Heisenberg chain, both in the massless and in the massive regime, so in the gapped phase and the gapless phase. The symbols are the numerical, are the exact ionization. Looking at the high temperature residue, and the curve is the beta ansatz. So you see that indeed you can get very far with this numerical technique. So now we jump on to.
Could you comment why this heat curve conversion is not necessarily the from calculating?
Well, in essence, you just have to do the commutator, and you see that, that there is no scattering of. It's essentially because it's the local energy density is a very simple form in the XXC case, so you just have to calculate it. There's no particular point about that. And indeed, if you do the same thing for the spin current, which is also a rather simple operator, you find that it does not commute. Actually, the fact that the spin current does not commute with the Hamiltonian does not necessarily mean that you don't have a finite Luder weight for the spin current. Indeed, it turns out that the spin current also has a finite Luder weight to its conductivity, and this has been an issue for quite some time, in particular at the fully isotropic point where there are different beta ansatz calculations, some which claim that the Luder weight is finite and others which claim that it is not, and actually only due to exact ionizations you can then determine which of the beta ansatz calculations actually is proper.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
This guy essentially undresses. So it has something to it, or it dresses up, as ever you like, to some quantity, which then finally runs through the system. and is non-dissipative. But for the heat, it's somewhat simpler. The heat just right from the start is a proper conserved quantity. So this is why you can nicely check if all this works. So this is our, so to speak, benchmark to see if things work. So now we jump to the spin ladder. And there, the point is, we don't have data answers now to see if any of what we are doing is right or wrong. So to at least feel comfortable, what we do first is we check for other thermodynamic quantities, like the specific heat or the susceptibility, comparing, taking a quantum Monte Carlo technique. In our case, we use the stochastic series expansion for very large systems, just like several tens of thousands of spins. And we compare what we get from the curves are just the exact ionization, and the symbols are the quantum Monte Carlo, just to see if the exact ionization and the quantum Monte Carlo give the same result. So we're pretty sure we can do the right thing regarding the thermodynamics with the exact ionization. So then we go one step further and look at the Duda weight of that guy. And you immediately see that, again, Duda weight as a function of temperature, there's a huge difference in the high temperature regime. Indeed, there are large finite size oscillations from, say, 8 to 18 sites. So now what do you make from that? Again, you take the high temperature residue out here, where we know that the exact ionization essentially gives the proper answer to the question. And you plot it, say, normalized to the high temperature residue at, say, 8 sites. Eight sites. And you plot it as a function of 1 over system size. And what you see is for various rung couplings that the Duda weight dives. So that tells you the system is non-ballistic. It must be dissipative. And we have checked that this is true for essentially all of the non-integrable region of our, so to speak, model Hamiltonian. Just to show you two other examples. This is for dimerized chains. If the dimerization is large enough so that there is a sizable gap in the numerical calculations, you can immediately see that as a function of system size. 1 over again, the high temperature residue of the Duda weight dives. And here, now the x, 1 over system size. 1 over system size. Yeah? So the point is that as you go to the thermodynamic unit, the Duda weight just essentially goes to zero. Very different from the XXE case, where the Duda weight just sticks finite. Okay? So, as I said, we believe that things are dissipative here. And just to make the story complete, if you take frustrated spin chains, so spin chains which have a next nearest neighbor coupling and go beyond criticality, so in the massive phase of those guys, again, the Duda weight as a function of system size dives once the system is beyond criticality, so has a finite gap. We are not so sure about what happens below criticality because we cannot get convergent results here. So we just would like to stick to the massive phase of those systems. So sub-summing, we can give a very clear-cut answer to dissipation or no dissipation in these systems. Whenever you break integrability, these systems turn out to be dissipative regarding their thermal transport. This can be different for the spin current. So this is it's not necessarily the same for all for all types of currents that you look at. While in the integrable case, so the XXE chain, we actually have ballistic transport. And this agrees with what people find from other sides of the world doing bosonization, at least qualitatively, in the sense that they would also agree with us that example for the dimerized systems and the frustrated systems, we have dissipation. So now.
Can you turn this around and say that it's the energy conservation, that it's basically the conservation law which gives you a conserved energy current that makes it solvable?
Well, in a sense, once you have integrability, there are many, many conservation laws around, and it is essentially something that is related to what you say. It's essentially something that is related to what you say. Right? So the point with bosonization is that there are some very general arguments as to the number of how many irrelevant and incommensurate operators you have coming from the continuum limit, adding so that you reach the lattice limit. And it turns out that there's a very striking result, namely, as long as you have one irrelevant and incommensurate operator in your theory, then you can still construct one conserved current, and you will still have a conservation law. But that is a very peculiar case, and whenever you have more than one, you essentially find no conservation laws anymore for the current. So this is the way how people from Bose-Navier would eat it. Yeah? So then, once we know that everything seems to be dissipative, we at least have to give an answer to the experimental finding. And so, therefore, we have to, and this is, the most important information on this talk you have missed was this little number up here. It was counting from the number of view graphs down to the number of view graphs which you still have to suffer. Okay, so now what you see here is as a function of frequency, now we're looking at the regular part of the conductivity as a function of frequency for various system sizes, again at a fairly large temperature to be sure first what we are doing, and we're just fitting the zero frequency point of the regular part of the conductivity. And you can do that for various temperatures. Now, but the point is, as I've been trying to convince you of, is that only roughly to 0.5 times the exchange coupling constants can we be sure about what our finite system calculations will do. So now we are in we're facing a problem. The problem is, and now I'm coming back to the experimental result, the problem is that experimental data is available roughly to something like 300K, right? And the exact randomization can go down to maybe 600 or maybe 1,000K. Yeah? So we have to bridge a gap which is on the order of two times or one times the whole x-axis space in here. And in that gap, we cannot produce reliable exact magnetization results. So what we do, or what we resort to, is we take this curve, we take the experimental data, use an exponential activation law down here, and the known high temperature fall off of that data, and simply try to fit the data, and so to speak, extrapolate it to high temperatures, and then to make a connection to the theoretical calculation. So this is what is shown here in this graph. So essentially what you see here is you see the experimental data with this kind of fit here, shooting up, it goes way up here, and then it comes down again, right? At those temperatures where we can actually safely do finite system diagonalization. And what you should take away, obviously there are various curves on here which describe a range of possible exchange couplings on the spin ladder, on the telephone number compound. And what you should take away from this here is that at least to within factors of maybe 2 or 5, we get a proper size of the heat conductivity. So this is not to claim that we have exact agreement between experiment and the theory, but at least we're not off by a factor of 10 or so. We're coming into the right ballpark. So anyway, this extrapolation, saying from something like 300K up to where we can actually do the exact magnetization, is dangerous. We are well aware of that, but we simply are have to work a little harder on the numerics to maybe bridge this gap. So we would say at this point that experiment on the spin ladders and an interpretation in terms of intrinsic scattering simply due to magnetic excitations on the spin ladder is at least consistent. And it also tells you that these systems should be highly susceptible to any kind of disorder that you put in, because a little bit of disorder will very strongly influence these conductivity values. And indeed, this is work in progress, where we find that if we look at disordered samples, then we have additional scattering channels, which then strongly suppress these values, and the effect of disorder is yet to be observed. So I hope that I have convinced you that thermal transport in spin matters is anomalously large and can be understood purely in terms of intrinsic magnon, essentially, or triplet scattering on these systems, and it is non-ballistic, as has been claimed for quite some time. So thank you.
Can you tell us what are the differences between the spin structures? Why is it in this one direction that the magnons are so favorable in transporting heat?
You mean maybe that is a question to the, is that a question to the real space structure of the material?
In real space magnetic structure, I'm just wondering.
Probably that's what you want to know.
How is spin arranged?
So you want to know about the difference between this and that curve?
Well, I want to know how the spin directions are arranged so that the y that in that direction is more.
Okay. So I will try it this way. So the structure is like that. The system has ladders, right, which run along this direction. So the reds are the copper. And there are two types of oxygen, 180-degree exchange oxygens, which form the ladders, and 90-degree oxygens, which essentially separate the ladders from each other. So you have a plane of disconnected, roughly speaking, disconnected ladders running into the C direction. So you will have essentially triplet moles, which propagate along the C direction. There's also a chain down here, but the chain doesn't play too much of a role. That is another story to tell. We can understand by looking at different ways of realizing the telephone number compound that actually the chains don't really play a role in this heat conduction experiment. And also by the fact that the exponential rise here is directly connected to the spin gap of the ladder. So the ladder guy this is the ladder. Yeah. So this is where the magnons propagate. And transverse to that, there's essentially no dispersion of the magnetic excitation. So that's why you have this very small contribution, transverse.
Could you explain that statement, why the chains don't quantitate? Because you could say this is for sure, but it's a transverse.
Yeah, the chains, as you know, these chains are always contain additional charges and ordering phenomena, so they're actually not true chains. And then also there's nice experimental scanning where people just look at, for example, the pure strontium copper oxide, where we know that there's charge order going on the chains. And if you compare the two experimental sets of data, this feature essentially looks completely identical. So you have totally different, so to speak, structures of the chain and still completely identical curves here. So that makes it rather unlikely that the chains play a role. But you're right, if the guys would be spin 1/2 antiferromagnets with chains, they would be very well important. And we know that for the pure strontium copper oxide chains, there are, again, let me just show that, just to wrap this up. So, this is data. For the two, pure chain materials. Now the scale is somewhat different. The guys have chosen a log scale and still along the C direction, so this is where the magnetic chains run, you have this large difference between the two contributions, which is roughly one order of magnitude. Now the problem with this data is that you see this huge bump here. So there are phonons and imperfections. This is exactly the problem with the purely 1D system. You immediately have to worry about what extrinsic scattering will do to your system. That will essentially dominate your transport. So these people then have to worry about how to subtract this guy, this first bump, so to speak, to really get down to the magnetic stuff. And this also shows you that they have rather large error bars on where to put the mean free path, since these are just two ways of subtracting the background. So the way how you really get rid of extrinsic scattering is a problem here. And obviously, if there would be chains in the spin ladder compounds that are relevant, we would expect to have an additional contribution like that. Yeah.
So you pointed out that you can't do a present time frequency thermal conductivity measurement.
Not at low enough temperatures.
So
not at low.
If someone hands you a new ladder compound, and you would like to say which of the two classes
So I think once we know what the model Hamiltonian is, you're asking a question. This is a very good question. So what I would do after having done all these calculations, the first thing I would tell my friend from the experimental department, I would tell him, please disorder this thing. He wouldn't want to do that, but I would try to force him. And because we know that disorder will have a large impact on systems which are integrable, that I would first like to see is the system somehow protected by in that sense that there is already no due to it, and disorder will be an additional effect, or is the system such that a little disorder will immediately have a huge impact, and this will at least guide me as to look into integrable or non-integrable models. But usually the way that these systems are considered is that people have a great deal of understanding of if this is a chain or a ladder. But I agree, this if I wouldn't even know about the Hamiltonian, this would make life complicated.
No, sure.
This is
along the same lines. I mean, you could also build the carriers in the ladders, as they're still animatively large, whatever animatus means, large thermal conductivity coming from the ladders.
Mm-hmm. So here are some preliminary experimental data on what happens with disorder. So now maybe I even have to step back again a little bit from what I told you, right? the point is, obviously, here you see, these guys have been doping with zinc, right? And what they claim from their data is that essentially they can limit the mean free path that I was telling about, the 700 lattice constants, they can cut it down essentially to the mean zinc-zinc dopant distance. So essentially putting in impurities will have quite a large effect, at least on the low temperature curve, because you can immediately go from 700 lattice constants, say, to a mean zinc-zinc distance. And this is essentially what they see here. They dope the guy. And you can see that there is a strong suppression, while the phonons, essentially remain the same. So there's this huge impact on the magnetic.
Impurity concentration for the first one is then 0.125 divided by 24?
Well, I usually tend to look at this picture here. This tells me the mean zinc-zinc distance. And what they do is they just take our little kinetic formula that I've been showing at the very start, and look at their exponential upturn here, and then they try to fit the magnetic mean free path. And so they claim they know the zinc-zinc distance, and they correlate that with the mean free path.
Yeah. I was curious, what does this actually tell you? I mean, it's unlikely this dropping is due to the magnon testing.
Which drop?
Well, when you start to zinc, I mean, we change 10% zinc and then suppress so much that.
Oh no! This just tells you this exactly. This is exactly the point. It tells you that as long as the magnons run along essentially freely, right? Then you have this huge transport. What a little bit of non-magnetic impurities will immediately shrink the mean free path of these excitations down to essentially the non-magnetic impurity distance. So this is just the other way around. It has to be taken as a very clear evidence for the fact that. This is now pointing to something where I understand that my experimental colleagues are even thinking about patents. So they would like to have field-driven heat switches. So they think about, for these guys, J is 1,000 K. So this is not so interesting for applications. But they are thinking about taking organic materials where the gap is much smaller and where the Zeeman energies are accessible, say, by lab fields. And so they're thinking about even switching heat currents with magnetic fields. And that's also why we have been looking into the combined heat and field gradient calculations. This was exactly the reason why we did that. So there are cross coefficients, like from electrical cross coefficients. So there are kind of Seebeck type equivalent terms that you can look at.
Why is it quartz?
Quartz. Oh. I just learned that people can make this stuff very pure, but I was also told not to be too strong on this point because so they can just make it very clean. Let's see, where is it? Here. So they can make it very clean. But I also understand that it has some temperature dependence to it, yeah? And I guess since this is room temperature and it can still freeze out some phonons, I don't know really about the temperature dependence of that guy, so.
I would have thought all there is phonons.
Yeah, it's true. There are phonons, and so this is exactly the point. All there is are phonons. These things are so pure that just phonons remain. And I just don't know the full temperature dependence of this. I just know that this is usually taken to be a very large value. No, I would just turn it the other way around. I mean, exactly, just for the spin ladders. I mean, a little bit of coupling immediately is a relevant perturbation. It drives you away from integrability, and I think the spin ladder. I mean, just for the material itself is completely off from integrability because you essentially have the strong run coupling case. You have essentially the same coupling across the legs and the rungs. So this is very far away from that. I know that there are people that believe that maybe there's some attractive thing going on where the region of integrability can be extended to explain experiments, but I don't think that this is the case for these materials.
Then you should essentially never expect the case that you're describing for, right? That disorder has a very, very strong effect.
Other than you really have integrable models.
Yeah. Right?
Well, I think these strontium cuprate chains are believed to be very, very good realizations of pure Heisenberg chains. I get that from experimental situations. I think these are as close as you can get to a Heisenberg chain. But I agree, anything little at low temperatures may kill the stuff.
Right. Okay, so I want to thank all speakers of this session again.